Good morning, Santa Barbara. This is KCSB 91.9 FM, and you're tuned in to the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent Poodle Radio.
Every breath you breathe. So I'll make the time if you can make believe.
Hey, living in a fortress. Hey, safe from the madness. Hey, hey, keeping every promise. When I walk, there will be no.
KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent Poodle Radio. Right now you're enjoying the sounds of Ages and Ages. That's all one word, Ages and Ages, with No Nostalgia. They're playing the Bico Co-op Garage here in Isla Vista on Friday, April 15th. This is one of the many tracks you'll hear this show, organized as always by the Indies pop culture editor Ali Cumingore. Well, today we've got, as usual, a packed show going a three-segment deal, as we've been doing recently. We're talking about alternative energy in Santa Barbara. We're talking about alternative housing in Santa Barbara later on. We're talking about more wine stuff because the Vintners Festival is coming up starting tomorrow. So no end of Santa Barbary type material. So we're going right into it. You might have seen already because we're now on Thursdays. Of course, Poodle Radio airs the day the paper comes out. You might have seen the cover story on green energy in Santa Barbara. It is not easy being green, it turns out, especially if you're in a place like this. And right here in the studio joining me is the author of that story, Brandon Fastman, also a graduate student at UCSB, and he has been looking into this for quite some time now, wrote up 4,000 words, of which you'll read 2,600 or so in the paper, but they are 2,600 good words, very informative words, words I wonder why I don't hear more often. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And we hear a lot about green energy, green causes in Santa Barbara. Your story takes a different angle in that this isn't about how cool Santa Barbara is with green stuff necessarily, but how hard it can be to do this stuff, right?
Exactly. So I started out by trying to do an overview of the alternative energy initiatives in the county. And there's actually less going on than I thought. So then I sort of turned my attention to figuring out why there isn't more.
Now, I'm just adjusting my mic because it popped off the stand here, but what the little inside KCSB talk, but what, I mean, what did you expect? What did you think you would see when you went out on the survey of alternative energy?
I thought maybe we'd be, you know, building wind turbines all over the place inland, or there'd be solar panels everywhere. And there are actually a lot of solar panels going up in the county, on private houses and city buildings and so forth. You'll see them on the highway. But if you look at it from a numbers perspective, the amount of energy we get from renewable sources is just, you know, a tiny fraction of a percent of the amount of energy we use. And that's kind of what surprised me.
So here in Santa Barbara, for context, where are we getting most of our energy from? Like, where's our actual source? If, you know, I might have a solar panel on my home. I don't, because I live in an apartment complex. But if, I mean, I get a little bit from that, power my coffee maker, what have you. But where are we getting most of what we're using?
That's a good question. We get it from the public utilities that are mostly powered by fossil fuel powered plants. There's the Diablo Canyon nuclear facility.
Right, we were talking about that on a previous show with Nick Welsh about, you know, how it might fall apart in an earthquake or whatever.
Uh-huh. And I actually don't know how to trace where the, you know, the source of the energy that we get in our home.
But as far as the green energy now, I mean, well, you have a line in the story that I mentioned off mic beforehand, like, yeah, imagine trying to buy 3,000 acres of prime real estate in Santa Barbara to build one of these things. Like, the cost alone of land here has got to stop a lot of the stuff in its tracks, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of barriers to building something big in Santa Barbara County. And there's really no bad guy, I don't think. There is no smoking gun, no reason... Right there.
No cartoon villain twirling the mustache.
Right.
You will never have alternative energy, Santa Barbara.
Exactly. So there's kind of a confluence of factors that make it hard to build here, one being the price of real estate. So if you're buying land in Illinois, you're going to make a much higher profit on your wind farm, let's say, than if you're buying land in Santa Barbara County. It's hard to get through the environmental review process in California, and apparently Santa Barbara County is especially rigorous in going through environmental review and making sure the impacts to the local environment are mitigated. So there's fear of lawsuits. And then there are local environmental impacts. If you're building any sort of large-scale facility, you're going to be possibly taking up agricultural land, impacting species, displacing habitats, maybe cutting down trees. In the case of wind turbines, you're killing bats and birds.
I guess something flies into those sooner or later.
Right. And then there are the aesthetics. You know, some people just don't want to see these things on their property or near their property or marring their view. But I think behind all these factors, there's an idea of environmentalism. And the idea is that we should protect our local resources. I think it's, some people refer to it as a pollution model, right? We don't want our land or our ocean polluted, or our air polluted. But I think global warming, or the energy crisis kind of defies that pollution model because it's a global problem. So as one consultant, told me, if we're not producing renewable energy here, they're going to be drilling for oil somewhere else in the world. Maybe not off the California coast where we have restrictions. Maybe in Venezuela, though, or in the Gulf. So the effects of climate change as well are global. If we're pumping carbon into the atmosphere, we're not just changing the climate above our heads. You know, this stuff is changing the climate all over the world. So how do we, you know, there's those bumper stickers that say, think globally, act locally.
Yes, yes.
In my article, I had a little riff on them. I said it's much easier to do on a bumper sticker than it is in Santa Barbara County. How do you actually, you know, do that? How do you mitigate a global environmental crisis right here in Santa Barbara?
There seems to be some attitude in Santa Barbara that, like, well, you know, we've got some form of perfection here, whatever, if you want to think of it that way. We got to keep it perfect and kind of forget what's going on outside of our borders because, you know, we're protecting what we have. But according to the research you've done, that's probably not a good plan, generally speaking.
Numbers wise, it's not. So there are a lot of people who say we should put solar panels on every house and building in the city. You should, you know, keep like energy production in urban sectors and leave rural areas pristine. And I put that question to Megan Burney, who's the renewable energy specialist at the Community Environmental Council, and she said that they do advocate for putting panels up on every building in the city, but that's still not going to do it.
And even then, you're not making much of a... You're not making a whole lot of energy then.
Right. Not enough, at least. So there, it looks like there's going to be a wind farm going up near Lompoc. It's being built by this international company called Acciona. And then there's a proposal working its way through the process now for a 40 megawatt solar farm near the city of Cuyama. And the maximum capacity of the wind farm is 97.5 megawatts, I believe. They're building it in phases, so it won't get that big for a while if it does. But if you add them up together, an optimistic estimate says that provides 5% of our energy needs. So these two seemingly massive projects are still only accounting for, you know, a fraction of our energy.
Now, how much of that can you chalk up to the sort of Santa Barbara issues we've been talking about, specific to Santa Barbara, and how much of that is like, this is the technology we're working with at this moment for green energy? Like, it's not to the point where you're going to get a huge amount of energy yet.
Well, I think there's a lot of people hope that technology is going to save us. But, you know, I wonder how long you can keep kicking the can down the road. So I interviewed E.O. Wilson. He's an entomologist, but he writes books for general audiences, and he's a Harvard professor, and he's famous for popularizing the term biodiversity.
And soon to visit UCSB, writer, has he already come by?
He came last week.
Oh, if so, you missed him. Sorry, audience.
Yeah.
Read his books.
I missed him too, but fortunately I got to speak with him on the phone. And he says, you know, we should never disrupt ecosystems. If we think hard enough, we can figure out how to preserve all the biodiversity on Earth. And I don't know if I buy that completely, because you can think forever. And so there's also another person I spoke to was an activist. He's named Patrick Wiesert, and he's written an editorial in our paper and other nearby media outlets, and he calls these companies that build these big alternative energy facilities big green. And you know, he compares them to big auto or big oil,
the whole suite of big whatever. Right. You want no different.
They don't care about the environment. They're destroying ecosystems, and you know, they're just sort of wearing this cloak of environmentalism. And I think he has half a point, or he has two halves in two different areas.
He has a point if you add that up.
Right. So these companies are supposed to make money. I think that's their main objective. So there's nothing wrong with being skeptical of them. It's probably pretty healthy. And I think, you know, his other half of point is that, you know, he's worried that they're going to destroy the countryside. He lives on the Carrizo Plain in San Luis Obispo County, which is this really, you know, pristine, nationally protected area, with a ton of biodiversity. It's kind of a jewel. And they're proposing, two companies are proposing two very large solar farms up there, much bigger than the one in Santa Barbara County. And, you know, is it worth destroying our natural areas to provide for our energy needs? So I think it's something we have to consider. But I think you can't have it both ways. You can't save every bird and tree and get all the energy you want. So something's right. Got to give.
Magic will not intervene. And, I mean, are we really talking destruction of our natural world if we're talking building green projects? Like, are we necessarily blighting the landscape?
It depends on who you talk to. I mean, some people yes. could argue that a windmill is, or a wind turbine is beautiful. This book I read, well, I've read some of it while I was writing this article. It's pretty influential on my thinking. It's called Breakthrough, and it's by these two environmentalists who tried to sort of shake up the establishment a few years ago. And there's some problems with it, but, you know, I think they I think they're on top of a few things. So, you know, they say, you know, why is a wind turbine, you know, maybe an offshore turbine any different than seeing the sails of a sailboat?
Right.
And
you get down to it. You wonder, what is the difference?
Right. And I also think that environmentalism often works on this premise that there's the human world and the natural world, and they're separate.
As if humans were not organic creatures, you know?
Right, who used resources. And I think there are places that have seen very little human activity and don't have much of a human imprint. And there are also places that humans have just, you know, totally destroyed or erased, you know, all semblances of a pre-human world from. But I don't think that describes, you know, most of the Earth. So I think sometimes we do ourselves a disservice by thinking, you know, nature should go here, humans should go here. It makes it hard to get anything done.
And finally, doing all the research for this article and finding out what people are doing, I mean, what do you now want to find out more about as far as how people are working on green technologies here or elsewhere? What's going to be the exciting thing for you to follow up on?
I think that in the short term, solar power is the most promising source of energy. And that is partially because it doesn't need to be scalable or scaled. So 100 solar panels scattered throughout Santa Barbara, assuming they get the same amount of sun, gives you the same amount of energy as 100 panels right next to each other on a solar farm. And then there's people at UCSB working on organic thin film solar cells. They're not efficient enough to be marketed yet, but it seems like there's some exciting technology. There's another startup in town I'm hoping to catch up with in the next couple weeks that claims they can make solar cells much more efficient. So that's where I think there's some promise in the near future.
I've been speaking with Brandon Fastman. He's a graduate student at UCSB and the author of the cover story just out today in The Independent. It's not easy being green on alternative energy in Santa Barbara County. Brandon, thanks for taking the time this morning.
Thanks so much.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. More talk on the way about housing and wine. So stay tuned for the next two segments on Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Indy on KCSB 91.9 FM. KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent, Poodle Radio on KCSB 91.9 FM. You're hearing right now to another one of those cuts, wrangled by pop culture editor Ali Cummingore. It's Those Darlins. No G, Those Darlins. Screws Get Loose is the song. They're playing the Mercury Lounge this Saturday, April 16th. By the way, I should mention to you that the column on KCSB, right, the KCS Beat, comes out every Tuesday. This week, it is on, what is it on? Frank and George, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's a show that airs Monday mornings, 9 a.m. to 10, and you've just got to hear it. There's no sense in even talking about what it is, because it is in a sense, everything. Getting back to the show, we are talking to two representatives from the Housing Authority of Santa Barbara today about a new, I guess I want to find the right term for this, so I'm going to ask them, but I will call it a new and fairly exciting alternative housing. I don't want to say project, because project has negative connotations in a sense, but it is a project, an important project, and it's one that you don't think of when you think of that word. Let me just pop up Studio A here on the mixer, because that's where they're sitting, and I will be talking today to Rob Fredericks. He's the Deputy Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer, and Veronica Loza, Director of Housing Management. They're both, as I said, from the Housing Authority. And Rob, Veronica, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I had to blow through that intro because we have so much to talk about. Now, tell us about Artisan Court. What is it?
Right. Well, as you said, we don't like to call our portfolio of affordable housing as projects, because
yeah,
they do have negative connotations. We call them developments.
Developments.
Artisan Court is our newest development that we just opened up. It's a a total of 56 units. 55 of them are studios, all 450 square feet. And then we have a two-bedroom manager's apartment on site as well. And we have a nice community room and a supportive services office. And the reason we have those supportive services offices is because this development is serving it's permanent supportive housing, and it's serving those with special needs, those people that are folks that are disabled or coming from homelessness. A third of the units are serving youth that are aging out of foster care, which is really fantastic because our county really hasn't had that number of units to be able to be directed, besides La Mirada, to serve as permanent supportive housing for the youth that have aged out of foster care. So it's nice that we're able to serve them. And then we also, another third of the units are serving low-income downtown workers, those that are, you know, your restaurant workers, your store clerks, your office receptionist that just needs an affordable place to live and that works in the downtown core where they can walk to work rather than getting in their car and driving to work.
So where exactly is this development? I mean, we know how many units it is, and we know what it's for. But where is it specifically? Where would you find? Where would you see it?
It's downtown at 422 East Coda Street, and so that's right between Laguna and Olive Street. It's right in the middle of the block there. If you're familiar with our Arnaldi's restaurant, it's sort of kitty corner to Arnaldi's restaurant.
This place is really near where I live. Okay. Now that I think about it. Cool.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. The architecture, I recommend anybody to drive by, and they would, again, like all of our other developments, go, wow, that's affordable housing. I can't believe it. They would think it's a nice condominium development, the way we build our units. The city of Santa Barbara and the Architectural Board of Review, they hold our feet to the fire just like they would any other private market developer to make sure that our developments are built to the standards that Santa Barbara's demand.
And now this is an important question to go into, and perhaps you both have an opinion or an idea about this, but how close to the top priority is it to make these developments not look like projects?
I think it's very important to the Housing Authority because of the stigma or the not in my backyard NIMBY effect that we get from our properties. So it's very important for the Housing Authority to ensure that our properties blend into the community, that not only because of the community, but also because of the clients we serve, so they feel very much a part of the community and they're not targeted, as you said earlier, projects, housing projects, but we are truly a part of the community in every sense of the word, so architectural-wise, and giving that helps, I think, our clients also feel like they're not a standout.
Now, I want to mention some of the sort of greatest hits of the Housing Authority. I was reading you were involved with Garden Court, which we had a segment on a couple months back, and I wanted to get this name right in the other one. Well, tell me, I mean, other than Garden Court, what do you consider to be representative of the Housing Authority's efforts in this direction?
Well, we have our Casa de las Fuentes development that was about 8 years old now, and it's on the corner of Castillo and Carrillo Streets, right in the downtown gateway coming into Santa Barbara. And that was the first development in the city specifically targeted to assist low-income downtown, the downtown workforce, those that would use alternative means of transportation, to go to work, meaning mainly your feet. You can walk
right
to work rather than getting in a car. You could take a bus or the trolley to work, and that's another just beautiful gem in our portfolio of providing affordable housing that again doesn't look like affordable housing. And what we do is from the design phase early on, we look at the site and look at how can we make this a community, a place where people can truly feel like they're at home and it's their community. And then we build it from that vantage point. We design it and we build it.
And this seems like it's a challenge that has been sort of maybe the main challenge, but one of the trickiest challenges for designers of developments like these is making it a place where a community can arise, and doing that in sort of a design way, like opening up all the possibilities for community. And is it, I mean, is this a problem people have figured out these days, or is it still like, how is it still kind of an X factor that you have to capture, if you know what I mean by that?
Well, I think more and more affordable housing developers are getting it. They're getting that X factor that's been out there, and we're starting to see other developments that are really is capturing that sense of community. And that's something that's been paramount for us in all of our developments. And, you know, like you said, Garden Court, Casa de las Fuentes, El Carrillo next door to Casa de las Fuentes. It was our first development, our housing first model to move folks that from that are living on the streets into housing. And that's 62 units on a half acre. So it's very dense. It's 122 units per acre. But you know what? Right. You go into that development and it really feels nice. And people that moved in there, they don't want to leave. They like living there because it has that great sense of community.
Now, maybe you can both tell me as well, what have you learned has worked? What works well? I mean, from the past developments, what has emerged as just the strategies that are ideal for these kinds of developments?
I think what we've learned with Casa de las Fuentes and El Carrillo, now Artisan Garden Court, is that when you build a property that feels good when you walk in, it's open, even though it's high density, it's open, you have community rooms, you have courtyards. Believe it or not, you can't see them from the outside, but you walk in and there's these awesome courtyards that the tenants can, you know, come into and hang out, and they just, I think that's what we've learned from building our newer properties, and making them feel airy and comfortable and like home. So
what's different specifically about Artisan Court, which of course recently opened? I don't know if I mentioned to the listener that it's brand new. It opened when?
Well, we had our grand opening yesterday for the community.
Right, brand new.
The official ribbon cutting, but the residents moved in on March 31st.
Right, so still it's still fresh. Brand, it's yes, fresh. But fresh. So what's different? What are the main qualities that set Artisan Court apart from what has come before?
Well, I think Artisan Court is a building block of different aspects of what we've built before to you know, we try and build upon what we've done best, our best practices. And one of the things that we have found that's very important, especially when you're serving special needs populations and the youth aging out of foster care, is you've got to provide the wraparound supportive services. You can't just give a roof over someone's head and say, okay, good luck. You want to provide structure, life coaching. You want to provide people to be there for them, to set goals, to give them educational opportunities, financial literacy training, that sort of thing. We try to give a hand up rather than a handout to really get them on a path towards success.
The four walls and the roof are step one of like 1,000.
That's correct.
Exactly. Right.
Now, we should get this information out here as well, because I don't want this to slip past the listener. What is the Adopt a Room campaign?
The Adopt a Room campaign, we first came up with that idea when we built El Carrillo. And basically, it was you donate $300 to Adopt a Room. It's tax deductible. And we use that money to actually furnish a room in its entirety. And so what we mean by that is we buy the dishes, you know, we buy pots, pans, cleaning supplies, a broom, whatever you think you would need, the essentials to when you walk into your own apartment and what you think you're going to need to begin a new life. So that money, basically, you adopt the actual room and we furnish it with that dollar amount.
And so is this going on now? I mean, can rooms still be adopted in like an ongoing way, or is this a done deal? What's the story with how that's working?
It is ongoing. You know, we've raised enough funds to adopt each and every room at Artisan Court, but as units turn over, we're always going to find a need to have those kind of essential things that make a place a home to supply as new residents move in.
Opportunities for readoption.
Correct, okay. Correct. And we have our nonprofit affiliate, Second Story Associates, that's housed at the Housing Authority, and that's the 501c3 nonprofit that folks can give to donate to the Adopt a Room program. And they can go to our website and click on Adopt a Room, and it'll take them to the online form where they can donate online if they so choose.
And to make this extra clear, because there's going to be listeners who hear this and they say, you know, this is a cause I can get behind, this type of affordable housing in Santa Barbara, you know, or maybe they know somebody who needs it. The website, again, that they should go to is what? What is the URL for that?
Our main website is www.hacsb.org.
HACSB.org. And you know, they can adopt a room, they can donate. What other sorts of ways might a listener want to get involved or be able to get involved?
Well, I think that by donating, of course, that's one way. Also, if a listener wants to get involved, if they have programs they can offer the youth or ideas that are out there that we haven't come up with, we would love to hear about them. We know there are a lot of organizations and groups out there that are willing to come and talk to the youth and our special needs clients. Most of our downtown workforce housing clients are quite young because they're just starting off. And like Rob was saying, there are clerks, there are bankers, bank clerks. And so having anybody come out and just give, you know, talks and or come up with any ideas that what we may have not come up with to help our residents would be great.
I've been speaking with Rob Fredericks and Veronica Loza of the Housing Authority of Santa Barbara talking about the new development, Artisan Court. Rob, Veronica, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM. Going to keep things rolling, talking soon for the second week to the Executive Director of the Santa Barbara County Vintners Association. But first, a track from Ellie Goulding. It's Under the Sheets on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. Thanks again to Rob and Veronica from the Housing Authority of Santa Barbara for coming on, and Brandon before that talking about green energy. Now, as I've been promising you all show, it's the third segment. We are talking wine for the second week in a row, running up to the Vintners Festival, going on very soon. I mean, it's the 14th now, starts the 15th. So we have the executive director of the Santa Barbara County Vintners Association back again. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Colin.
And you have another winemaker here today. Who do you have here?
Well, he's more than just a winemaker, more. Colin. He's much more than that. This is Steve Fennell, who's the winemaker and general manager at Sanford Winery. He's also the president of our Santa Barbara County Vintners Association. Steve, good to see you, buddy.
Thanks. Good morning, Jim. Good to see you as well.
Welcome, Steve. Glad to have you here. Now, you've promised more than just a winemaker. So let us know. Let the whole audience know. What does he do? What makes him go beyond the usual designation?
Steve, tell him, because he's in charge of the entire winery operation, the vineyard. He's more than just the guy in the cellar with his nose in the bunghole. So.
Yes.
So to speak.
Although that is the fun part. So besides my involvement with the Santa Barbara County Vintners Association, my day job is the winemaker and general manager for Sanford Winery, which means that I get to be responsible for the winemaking, but I also look after the vineyard care and get involved with the retail operations as well. So I'm kind of responsible for everything on the property. So it keeps me busy.
It does sound that way, and it sounds like busyness is kind of the condition of the winemaker. As you know many winemakers, Jim, it sounds like they all, whether they are winemakers or beyond winemakers, they don't get a lot of free time.
Well, it isn't a question, I think, of free time. What draws people like Steve into this business is you aren't what you do. You do what you are. And so it just is a state of of being. You just do that. And that's what you enjoy. And that is, people don't really see it as a difference. You know, gee, right. It's Saturday. So, gee, it's Sunday. So
yeah, exactly.
They all run together. I don't want to be very Albert Camus about this, but I mean, you know, there is no exit. You know?
But I mean, that's good. I mean, can you confirm this?
Absolutely. In fact, I think what happens for people in this industry who have success or become successful or have the makings of success is it's a passion. And so very quickly, it does not seem like a job. It becomes what you want to do. And, you know, I think it's such a lifestyle and such a passion that you think about your vineyards all the time. You think about wines, and with wine and food, it all goes together. And you realize that, you know, sometimes you kind of have to think, wait a minute, I'm actually getting paid to do this. It really is a passion.
That's a thought you want to have.
What was Brad your first guest?
Meaning the first winemaker ever on the show?
No,
the
no,
one
no,
we
no,
talked
the,
to last
the
week.
The one just this morning about.
Yes. Oh, Brandon. Brandon Fastman. Yes.
Yeah, but he was talking about separating, man and nature, and I'm trying to say that the wine business is something very much like that. We don't separate wine and production and nature and other, there's a sustainable vineyard, but in our sense it's an entirely sustainable community, and that's something that we're very proud of showing at our Vintners Festival. This is not a separate event that is ongoing for something else. This is a vertically integrated event that is all of the members of the association. Many of them are growers as well. All of them buy fruit. I mean, it is one that is rooted in Santa Barbara County, because you cannot be a member of the association unless 75% of your production is grown here in Santa Barbara County. And so that idea of sustainability, and then going into the housing that you had just after, our wine community is very strong at making sure that its workforce has housing provided. So I mean, it's a great story, but it isn't just a story. It is a fact of life, and it you know, when I say that Saturday or Sunday, it that's the way it is, and no one cares. That's what keeps people here. No one wants to change it.
Indeed, and you know, we're tying it all together here, but I want to make sure to mention, you know, the Vintners Festival. We're just on the cusp of it, right? I mean, when's the official opening point?
Well, the key event, the Vintners Festival itself, is Saturday. April 16th, from 1 until 4, unless you bought a special VIP ticket, which got you in 1 hour early at noon. Mm. But the entire weekend, which is full of open houses and special events at different wineries, begins tomorrow, April 15th. I say that because the association offers a Vintners Visa, if you will, that... we have over 40 of our over 100 members offering tasting through this visa, and for a small fee, $35 if you buy it, $25 if you buy it with a ticket to the festival, you can choose 12 of those, and your tasting fee is waived. And we ask, Colin, don't try and do it in one day. Don't even try and do it in 2 days. Spread it out over the 4 days. Enjoy yourself. You know, be moderate.
Recommended strategies, yes, from the executive director right here. And Steve, please, I want to hear from you, you know, your perspective on the festival, sort of what's most interesting or exciting to you about it?
You know, it really is. It's a great weekend. It's fun for the producers as well as the visitors. And I think, you know, besides the visas and, you know, all of the other great opportunities for people to visit the wineries themselves, you know, the festival on Saturday, that, you know, all, unlike most other organizations in this business, you know, we have all of our members out there pouring their wine. So it's an opportunity for people to see the diversity of wines in Santa Barbara County, which is truly amazing. I mean, you can find just about every variety of wine out there and in very different styles. And with all of our, you know, various microclimates that we have, I mean, there's a really interesting range of wines, and it's just, you know, we have more than 100 member wineries and, you know, dozens of restaurants providing lovely local food. I mean, it really, really is a special event, and it's something we look forward to all year.
Now, the range of Santa Barbara County wine, this is something we touched on last time you were here, Jim, but I want to get sort of, I want to drill a little deeper into this to, I mean, how much of a range are we talking about? You know, maybe in wine geek terms, that's what we have to go to, but like how surprising would it be to the casual wine drinker, the variety of wines that people do manage to grow in Santa Barbara?
Well, there are over 60 different varieties planted in Santa Barbara County. And almost 60 of them produced as varieties themselves. Mm. Now, that having been said, some of those plantings are less than 5 acres. So I'm not talking about ranch fulls of these. But the idea that they can find a home and flourish is extremely exciting. As we talked about last week in the transverse nature, the east-west running mountain range and hence valleys of Santa Barbara County, from the ocean to the inland eastward area of the valley, roughly 27 miles, there's everything from you know, the coolest spots of Burgundy to the warmest spots of Bordeaux, and everything in between, the Rhone and Spain and Italy and all of those things, and people are finding different varieties. So if you happen to like San Grantino from Umbria in Italy, you can find a winery that's producing San Grantino. If you like Sangiovese from Italy, or if you like Tempranillo from Spain, there are people producing it, and producing it very well. Are they going to be identical to their European counterparts? No, that's the great thing. It is the flavor of Santa Barbara County with I would say, maybe the accent of Santa Barbara County with the flavor of those varieties, or vice versa, depending on. Colin, you know those things so much better than I do, accents and root forms.
Just don't test me on it. You know, I'll assure you that I do, but I choke. Now, you make it sound like this is the greatest place in the world to grow wine, but it seems like there's got to be some hidden challenges that go with that. To which I turn to Steve to ask, you know, is this just some wine growing paradise, or are there hidden traps here? Traps is maybe too much to say, but
yes and yes, it is wine growing paradise. And I actually came down from, I was making wine in Napa and had the opportunity over 5 years ago to come down here and make wine. And you know, this place has. Not only is it more exciting and more diverse, I think, to me it has the potential to be better. So it's really exciting. There are, however, always challenges, and I find where we are in the western portion of the Santa Rita Hills, there are numerous challenges, from cold in the spring. In fact, we just had some frost last week that kept many of us up pretty late at night. It's, you know, it's always a tough climate. What's interesting is we have a very mild winter, so we tend to get bud break early, but we very commonly have a cold spring as well, so that makes for some real challenges. You know, we have the benefit of, you know, rarely do we have significant rain events at harvest, but it seems like the last few years we've had some. There, you know, seems to be some interesting weather patterns of extremes the last few years. So there really are challenges, there's no question. But I think, you know, what we see, and certainly in Santa Barbara County, is, you know, our vintages tend to run from quite good to great. And the real challenge is, you know, just making the best of what we can every year. But I think when you look at the world of viticulture in different growing regions, you know, we really are blessed. I mean, we really are kind of spoiled. But there are challenges.
Standing out, I mean, I imagine would be a really big issue because of how much wine can be grown here. It's like, well, you're a Santa Barbara wine. What else do you have? You know, is that maybe something that comes up as well?
Well, it does. And something that goes along with that is the, and we touched a little bit on that last week. It's the difference. One of the things that Santa Barbara is known for is the development of its fruit character. So it isn't really a question of better or worse, than it is a question of difference and what is known here. And I hate to get back to the festival, but you know, it is the vintners with the, you know, S apostrophe possessive. It's our festival, and this is where this is about the wine of Santa Barbara County. There are plenty of other festivals, and we support all those other festivals. We're there, but this is the one festival that is our festival, that has our members, our winemakers, our winery owners, the people who work in the wineries at the festival. And so for people who are interested in the wine of Santa Barbara County, if they go to our website, which is SB, happens to be the initials of Santa Barbara. I don't know how that happened, but you know,
mystery.
SBCountyWines.com. Everything can be taken care of. A lot of, you know, you ask about other things. A lot of wineries here find that in that Mediterranean climate of the middle areas of, say, Santa Ynez Valley, some of them have been growing a lot of olive trees. And so there are a number of wineries that have olive oil, and some of them will be displaying their olive oil at the festival. We have several new wineries this year that have not been at the festival. We have Hilliard Bruce, a Pinot Noir vineyard in Santa Rita Hills. It'll be there for the first time. Point Conception Wines, the Kargasaki family, they'll be there for the first time as a member. They've been around, but they haven't been a member. A restaurant from Avant, which is the restaurant at Terravant, which is a cooperative wine production facility in Buellton. It is, Steve, would you say it's a state-of-the-art facility?
It's pretty amazing. They have definitely the latest, greatest in wine technology and tools. It's pretty interesting facility.
I mean, as a winemaker, can you go in there and do you sometimes say, I kind of wish I had that? Maybe not.
we're pretty traditional.
It is interesting, you know, that with the types of technologies used, you know, some stuff's impressive, some stuff is impressively enduring, shall we say, but everybody kind of has their own setup, right? I mean, they all want a different thing, every winemaker. They want to use a different thing.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that, you know, there's some things we agree on, but there are probably more that we disagree on. And, and it's fascinating for me because we actually have two vineyards. We have the Rinconada Vineyard, which is what surrounds the winery, but we also have the iconic Sanford and Benedict Vineyard. And we sell some fruit from Sanford and Benedict besides use it for our own. And, you know, remarkably, from the same block of the vineyard, different winemakers will make very different wines, because I think we all have a different idea in mind of what, you know, what that wine could be at its best. And so, you know, really with the hundreds, if not thousands, of decisions that are made in making a wine, from deciding when it's exactly ripe to pick, to how you process it, to how you age it, you know, there really are a lot of decisions along the way, and you make very different wines. So it's, you know, two winemakers cannot make the same wine, which I think is, you know, it's one thing that makes our business very different, is that, you know, on one level we're in competition with each other, but on another level we really aren't, because, you know, unlike many other industries, we can't copy each other. We all make different wines.
Hmm. Now, I should say, to wrap up the segment, that because KCSB is a non-commercial station, we should always make clear that the opinions of the guests on wines, wine technologies, and vineyards are their own, but I'm very glad to have these opinions here. So, Steve, Jim, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you, Colin.
And thank you.
It's been the second segment on the Santa Barbara County Vintners Festival going on this weekend, River Park in Lompoc. Jim, that's website one more time?
sbcountywines.com.
SBCountyWines.com. I've been Colin Marshall, and we're going to play another last track, Wrangled By the pop culture editor of the paper, Ali Cummingore. Of course, because this is the show of the Santa Barbara Independent, she is bringing us tracks every week of artists playing in Santa Barbara and around Santa Barbara. It's Mumford & Sons with The Cave. And where are they playing? Let's pull this up. Do I see it? Yes, I do. They're playing The Bull on Monday, April 18th. Before that, the track beginning this segment, Ellie Goulding, Under the Sheets, playing UCSB's Hub on Monday, April 18th. Hope to have you here next Thursday, 8 in the morning, for another Poodle Radio. If you want to hear this show again, it's independent.com for the complete archive. Thanks for tuning in. Behind. The harvest left no food for you to eat. You cannibal, you meat eater, you see. But I have seen the same, I know the shame in your defeat.